Now, welcome to another inspiring edition of Sound Insight with Dr. Tom Curran.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. This is Tom Curran. Hey, today I have a special guest. It is the Pope's astronomer. That's right, the director of the Vatican Observatory, Brother Guy Consolmagno. How's that? What a great name. He is with me today because he's in town to do a retreat this weekend. You're going to want to go to this retreat after you hear this interview. When we come back, we're going to dive right in with Brother Guy.
Hi, this is Dr. Tom Curran, and you know me as the host of Sound Insight. I am also letting folks know that as a realtor licensed in the state of Washington and in Idaho, I love serving Catholic families and others who are discerning a move for yourselves. It's much more than buying or selling a home. It's discerning a whole new life. If that's something that you would find a help in, if I could be of service to you, please be in touch. You can find out more at drtomcurran.com. drtomcurran.com.
Well, I want to welcome to the program Brother Guy Consolmagno, who he flew all the way from the Vatican just to be with me on the radio today. This is so amazing. Joining me in spoke, Brother Guy is smiling and laughing. Come on now. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. But first of all, I came by train, not flying. I have to admit, I didn't come by train all the way from Rome. I got back to the United States about a month or so ago, closer to 2 months now. And this is the tail end of a 6-week trip that basically started with me in the Midwest and seeing the eclipse.
Well, I got to say, that was, I have so many questions for you. Folks, you have no idea who we're talking to. There are so many distinctives, Brother Guy, about you on this program that I have been on the radio for 20 years. And there are some, you have no idea what records you've set. And I'm going to tell you about them in 1 minute. I'm trying to come up with a very clever question for you. And I've got to find my little tab to impress you. Okay. And if I said the number, 1.28 AU, do you have any idea what that refers to? 1.28 AU.
That's relatively close, actually. So no, I don't.
Okay. So brothers and sisters who are listening to me today, you have the privilege of listening to an interview with somebody who has had a meteorite named after him.
Try that again. It's an asteroid.
An asteroid. Thank you. I have never, ever interviewed someone who's had an asteroid named after him. How does that happen?
It happens by having friends who discover asteroids. Asteroids are relatively easy to get a name. There are more than a million that have been well enough detected. You can name them, and whoever detects them has the right to name them. So the names are not passed out, you know, willy-nilly. They're usually given for people who have some kind of connection to astronomy. But the best part is you can still be alive. I mean, I'm involved in naming craters, and you have to be dead 3 years to get a crater. So I'm in no rush to get a crater named after me.
That is neat. Folks, Brother Guy is the Pope's astronomer. What a neat title. Did you present that to him, or did he present that to you? Or did that come from Il Giornale della Sera? Where did that come from?
Well, I have no idea who first came up with that title. It's really only slightly true. I'm one of a dozen astronomers who work at the Vatican and work at the Vatican Observatory in particular. I'm the director. So, you know, if anybody gets that title, I guess it's me for as long as I'm the director. But in fact, we have had astronomers working at the Vatican Observatory since 1891 and astronomers working with the Vatican going back easily to the reform of the calendar, you know, 1582. In fact, astronomy was one of those courses that you had to master before you could be able to do a doctorate in theology or a doctorate in philosophy. You know, it was one of the main courses, along with arithmetic and music and geometry, I believe. So
the quadrivium?
That was the quadrivium, exactly. And those are after the trivial courses of the trivium, which were grammar and rhetoric and things like that.
Well, Brother Guy, the number 1.28 AU is the nearest approach of your asteroid to the Earth. Is that ringing a bell now?
That makes sense, I guess. I didn't realize it even got that close, but it's safely out in the asteroid belt and not likely to hit anytime soon.
Yeah, according to the website that tracks these things, your asteroid is not a threat to planet Earth. So thank you for not being a threat.
Very few people have ever seen me as a threat, trust me.
Oh, and just this, just again, people don't have a chance to interact with someone like you often. So I'm going to ask all of their questions as well. And so one of the questions is, what is an AU?
That's the average distance between the sun and the Earth. And because it's such a fundamental distance, it's called an astronomical unit. It is the unit that's used the most in astronomy.
And so so the 1.28 AU mean that it's, you got another distance between the sun and the Earth. You push that out and then a little bit, about a third of the way. And that's where you'll find the asteroid belt between Mars and Saturn. Is that right?
Or Mars and Jupiter. Mars and Jupiter. And in fact, the asteroid belt is mostly on the near side of that from, about 3 or 4 AU to where Mars is, which is just a little over. Mars is like 1.6 AU compared to the Earth at 1 AU. So it's about 2 AU. Yeah, it's the main belt is in that lovely region of space. It's mostly empty. When you see a plot of all the dots, you realize the dots are a zillion times bigger than the actual asteroids. It's pretty much empty space, which is why you can look right through it and see the planets.
That's so interesting. Brother Guy, you came over and you were around for this solar eclipse. Talk a bit about what was that like for you to experience that? I mean, there was so much hype around the solar eclipse from like a religious fervor standpoint and interpreting the end of the world kind of things. And so that's why you were here. Did you go to where they crossed, right to that place in Southern Illinois? And
I was actually not far from the two paths where the 2017 eclipse went and the 2024 eclipse went. There was one point in Illinois where that got to see both of them. I saw the 2017 eclipse from Kentucky, and we had a glorious view there. And I thought that was just really, really pretty. The 2024 eclipse was a little more stark. It didn't have that subtle beauty of the 2017 eclipse, but the ring was much brighter because the sun is much more active at this point. And it had something that I really didn't expect to see, a tiny red dot at the bottom of the shadow of the moon, which was in fact a solar prominence so bright that you could see it with the naked eye. And no photograph that I've seen has done justice to just how bright that spot looked to the naked eye. That was a shock, and that was exciting. So in terms of, you know, sheer beauty, I'd say the first one was better. In terms of the surprises and, well, what the heck? Once the eclipse started, I was jumping up and down like everybody else around me, just cheering because it was such a lovely sight.
So you mentioned it, you called it a solar prominence. What is that?
Well, the sun is this enormous ball of mostly hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and the fusion in the center creates an enormous amount of heat. Well, the heat gets out, it boils around, it stirs up magnetic fields. The top of the sun is covered with a very hot plasma, which is connected to these fields. And every now and then, when you've got a sunspot, some of the magnetic fields break through the surface and carry this plasma along with it. And these are jets. They look like flames, except they're maybe 2 or 3 times as big as the Earth. And you can only see them in a telescope that's designed to look at them because, you know, the sun is so much brighter. Or if you're lucky, during a solar eclipse, when the brightness of the sun is taken away by the moon's shadow. And it reminds you that the sun is a very active place. It's filling the air, the space around it with plasma, with atoms, or with broken up atoms. So you've got protons and electrons that are flying through space, boiling off in what's called the solar wind. And sometimes it hits the Earth, and it gets trapped in our magnetic field. And then those particles hit the top and the bottom where the magnetic fields come and touch the Earth's atmosphere. And you see the aurora borealis, the northern lights. So it's all tied together. And to my mind, this beautiful physics and this great hand waving that I'm doing is all the more spectacular because we didn't understand any of this until my lifetime. You know, the first theories of the solar wind were first proposed by a guy named Gene Parker in the 1950s when I was a kid. And Parker had a grad student, a postdoc working with him who became my thesis advisor. So, I mean, these are, you know, people that I knew, ideas that are now commonplace and in all the textbooks were done by people who, you know, were people I knew when I was young.
That is so striking. First of all, thank you for that explanation and the way you personalized it with your own history. Folks, the reason why I have the privilege and the gift of interviewing Brother Guy is that he is in Spokane. He's on the South Hill, folks. He's at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center. And last night, he had an evening under the stars. Tonight, beginning tonight and going until Sunday, there's a retreat that Brother Guy is leading on faith, science, and beauty in the stars. There's still room to come out to this event. It's really a singular opportunity to be able to interact with a person of such experience and prominence and insight, not only in the realm of astronomy, but also in the light of our Catholic faith and in light of the wisdom that our Holy Father, Pope Francis, has given us through his encyclical Laudato Si. And all of these things will be coming together in the personality that you're hearing come across the radio and Brother Guy. And he loves when I talk about him like this, and he's just shaking his head at me.
Well, the most important thing about this whole experience, I hope, is that it should be fun. It should be an experience of joy. One of my favorite writers, everybody's favorite writer, C.S. Lewis, wrote about experiencing God as being surprised by joy. To my mind, joy is a sign that God is present. And I see that in the joy you see in looking at the stars. And what the heck, if it's cloudy, looking at the clouds can be fun too. Being outdoors at night is something that I don't think we do enough of, except, you know, to dash from our house to our car and our car to wherever we're going. To just spend some time in the outdoors every night, breathing in, listening to the sounds, looking at the light in the sky, whether it's the moon or the light pollution, and being connected to this fabulous world that we're in, I think is a great way of getting to know and getting a little more familiar with the creator of it all.
So, Brother Guy, this you're touching upon things that have been very meaningful in my own life, and I reflect on these things, and I think of the transcendence and mystery of God and how we've lost a lot of sight of that in a culture that tends to be much more focused on the here and now and the material world. And it would seem to me that outer space, the heavens, is one of those created places where God is manifesting something of his mystery, his transcendence, his glory, that can help shake us loose from, let's call it a closed world that's so focused on the material and the here and now. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, let's start with the eclipse. One of the reasons everybody was so excited about it is that it's happening someplace other than the here and now. It's happening up in the sky, and yet it was shocking and marvelous and, you know, made the world dark and made the animals confused and made the horizon in every direction look like a sunset. And here's the thing about the eclipse. We human beings, with the intelligence that God has given us and the patience to do the right mathematics, we can predict when the eclipse is going to take place, where the eclipse is going to take place, how long it's going to last at any of these given places. We can predict that to the microsecond. And that is a triumph of the reasonability of the universe and the reliability of the creator of the universe, that he made a creator. Try that again. And it is a reflection of the reliability of the creator of the universe, who made a universe that we can rely on. You never know ahead of time just how what it looks like is going to affect you. You never know ahead of time just what that moment of beauty is going to do to you. So it's a God who is both imminently reliable and yet never lacking in the ability to surprise you. To me, studying the universe gets me that much closer, gets me that much more used to this wonderful creator God.
So going to C.S. Lewis, when he, in his space trilogy, goes to Mars and then Venus, right? And Perelandra and what's Malacandra? Well, whatever Mars was named. The point is
that... It's been so long since I've read it.
I know, my goodness. But he, one of the things he has Ransom say is that his experience of space was so fundamentally different than what he thought. He thought it was going to be a cold, empty space. And what he encountered was this overwhelming sense of life and abundance surrounding him. It sounds a bit like that's your experience in your, you know, your career. And you're a scientist. You sound like a poet, but you're a scientist. And you think of the rigor of science and distances and numbers. I go back to sort of cold, hard math, rather than the wonder and the splendor of and the awe of immersing oneself in the great vastness of space.
Well, you know, you wouldn't do this stuff if it wasn't fun. You wouldn't do this work if it didn't give you that innate deep pleasure. But let me give you an opposite example. Before I was a Jesuit, I taught physics at a little school called Lafayette College. It's in Easton, Pennsylvania. Lovely school. I really enjoyed it there. I loved it so much that I was inspired to join the Jesuits, thinking I would get to teach at one of their schools like Gonzaga. But no, they had to send me off to Rome. That's a different story. Here's the thing. When I was at Lafayette College, I was also the housemaster for the Honors House. So we had like 20 intellectually curious students. And when they would come to do a thesis, I would attend their thesis defense at the end of their senior year. When I was going to a physics thesis, the students would talk about the elegance of the equations and the beauty of how they all fit together. When I would go to an art defense, I would see the artist student saying, well, this piece balances that piece and the force of this counteracts the force of that. And of course, what really is going on is, in both cases, they were trying to use words to describe something that ultimately is beyond words. But it also reminds us that, in both cases, there were students. There were human beings. Science is something done by people. Art is something done by people. And the two are very close in that they feed that part of the human spirit that, you know, a Big Mac can't feed. And nothing wrong with Big Mac. So, you know, I'm happy to have a hamburger as much as the next guy. But it's not enough. We don't live by Big Macs alone.
Well, we live on wonder. We live on enjoyment. We live on events like your retreat that's coming up. It starts tonight, folks. It's Faith, Science, and Beauty in the Stars with Brother Guy Consolmagno. He's a Jesuit, and he is here at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center, ihrc.net, ihrc.net. You can still register. There is room. The event starts tonight at 6 o'clock, and it continues on until Sunday at 1 p.m. If you can't make the whole event, just reach out to the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center and find out what portions you can be at. Because this is, again, it's an opportunity that if you have any chance of being able to come around and be with the Pope's astronomer, the director of the Vatican Observatory, you don't want to miss that opportunity. So, Brother Guy, the Vatican Observatory, just to hear that the Vatican has an observatory is probably new and news to a lot of Catholics. Because when we think about exploring the stars and the Catholic Church, there's a name that pops up. Maybe you're familiar with that name, that makes it seem as if Catholics and the Catholic Church are completely against science and research into the stars. And of course, I'm talking about Galileo. So would you talk a bit about what the Vatican Observatory is, and then you can lead as much as you want into the Galileo issue?
Well, I think I'll start with Galileo, because you have to know that, you know, the church was doing astronomy before Galileo, during Galileo, after Galileo, and with Galileo. I'm an Italian, at least, you know, several generations removed, but the Consul Magno on my side comes from Italy, and we're proud of Galileo as a fabulous scientist. And I'm a Catholic, and I'm proud of Galileo as a good Catholic. Now, and like most people in our culture, we've heard lots of lies about Galileo. Here's three things everybody should know about Galileo. First of all, he was a good Catholic. His two daughters were both nuns. He was very close friends to Pope Urban VIII, the Pope who eventually, you know, seemed to have turned on him. And so the idea that he was this, you know, 21st century man trapped in the 17th century doesn't do him justice. It's not who he was. You want to get a sense of his personality. There was a wonderful book that came out a while ago called Galileo's Daughters. And it's based on the letters that we have that Galileo's daughter, sister, I forgot the name. Terrible. Anyway, one of his daughters, who was a nun, wrote these fabulous letters that we still have that have been translated. And it's a lovely book. And, you know, the woman who wrote it, Dava Sobel, is a good friend and a wonderful writer. She's not like trying to defend the church. She's Jewish, actually. But she is defending the sense of who Galileo actually was. The second thing is that he was a person of his time, and he made lots of mistakes, and his science isn't perfect, and that's okay, because science isn't supposed to be perfect. What he brought that no one else brought was an imagination and a sense of knowing what it was he was looking at. And you mentioned, you know, poetry. He was a really wonderful writer. That's why people read his stuff. And art, he was trained in perspective, something that, you know, the scientists in the north of Europe hadn't had yet. So when he looked at the moon, he could see it as a 3D object with mountains, something that if you hadn't been trained in perspective, you couldn't see. And the third thing about Galileo is that we don't know why he got in trouble. If you actually read the documents of the case, you can find those in translation. There's a book by a guy named Finucchiaro who has a book called The Galileo Affair, and he just translates, including the transcript of the trial. It's not what you would have people think it was. It was not, you know, Galileo defending science against these ignorant church people who refused to look through a telescope. Pope Urban VIII not only looked through Galileo's telescope, but wrote a long poem about how wonderful what he saw was and how wonderful Galileo was. So these were close friends. And it means that whatever it was that happened to cause Galileo to get in trouble in 1633 was strange and unusual and wasn't what happened to him a few years earlier and wasn't what happened a few years later. And, you know, you can go to Amazon and get 400 different biographies of Galileo. They'll all have a different story, which is to say nobody really knows what it is. What did happen, though, was by the end of the 19th century, there were political forces both in Italy, Europe, and the United States that wanted to make the Catholic Church look bad for various reasons. And that was the time when it looked like science was going to solve all of our problems. By golly, we've got telegraphs and steam engines. What more could we possibly want? And the feeling was that, you know, science was going to be the new religion. Well, that didn't quite turn out so well. At the same time, the church was saying, no, science is great. The church invented science. The church invented the universities where it came up. The church invented the logical way of analyzing things when it invented theology. And there were tremendous church people doing science up into the end of the 19th century. We all know about Gregor Mendel, who was a monk who invented genetics. We not only have Galileo, a wonderful Catholic, but Roger Boscovich, who came up with the atomic theory, who was a Jesuit priest. You look at the charger on your cell phone and you'll see amps and volts. Volta was a devout Italian Catholic. Ampere was a devout French Catholic. It's either wealthy noblemen or it's clergymen, because who else had the education and the interest and the free time, you know, to go out and gather leaves and sort and file them? So all of this meant that science was something being done by the church until the end of the 19th century. And the political thing in America was, oh, we got to keep those terrible Italians out of the country. People like my great-grandfather, you know, people with a vowel at the end of their name. We don't want them ruining the place. In Italy, it was the church was opposed to the unification of Italy when it meant conquering Rome and taking it away from the popes. And so the Italian government was anti-clerical. There were similar fights in Germany and similar fights in France between clerical and anti-clerical forces in the culture. When the theory of evolution came along, middle of the 19th century, wonderful way of describing how animals change over time and completely consistent with the scriptural idea of God who makes life out of dust. After all, some people took that theory and misapplied it miserably into the idea of social Darwinism. They took that phrase, survival of the fittest, and never bothered to read the rest of Darwin's books, I'm sure. They took that survival of the fittest and said, well, if I've survived and I'm rich and you're poor, it's because I'm better than you. I'm inherently superior to you. The world would be better off without people like you. Of course, that's what they were saying about the poor immigrants who were coming, who had given up everything to be able to get to America. And then, worst of all, they said, we will make a purer human race by sterilizing all the inferior people. Inferior being, of course, people who don't look like you and me, but like those guys over there. It was called eugenics. It was terrible science. It doesn't work. But it was terrible science in that it was horribly immoral. The church spoke out against it. And that's all the excuse these people needed to be able to say, aha, you see, the church is anti-science. And after all, look what they did to Galileo. And they always bring up Galileo because it's the only example they could find. So it's the end of the 19th century. These are the forces happening in Europe. The Italian government has conquered Rome, and the Pope is now living in just inside the walls of Vatican. And the Pope says, we're still an independent country, and we're going to have a national observatory. This will show the world that we support science, and it'll show the world that we're still a nation. So in 1891, Pope Leo XIII, the same guy who wrote that encyclical endorsing labor unions, Leo XIII establishes a national observatory, gives it a spot on the walls of the Vatican, and gets it involved in an international project to take photographs of the entire sky and map them out. So from the beginning, the Vatican Observatory was involved in international astronomical science. And that's true to this day. We've got a dozen astronomers now, all Jesuits, from four continents, probably a dozen languages spoken where we are. We're very active in the International Astronomical Union. Yes, we were involved in finding the correct classification for Pluto. It was not a demotion. It was recognizing that Pluto was special and different from the other planets. And if you think that being something other than a planet is worse than being a planet, then you're guilty of planetism. Who says that you only have to be planets?
I was going to say, that's astrophysical eugenics going on there. You're eliminating Pluto.
But no, we're not. We're saying this, that Pluto deserves its own classification. It's so special. Nice. Anyway, the point is that we started out to show the world that we've got this wonderful history of astronomy, that Catholics should not be afraid of science. We should embrace it. And that's a phrase straight from Pope Leo XIII, to embrace it. The fact, as you say, and unfortunately you're right, most Catholics don't know we exist, means that at the Vatican Observatory, we've been able to do a lot of good science, but we've fallen down on the job of letting the world know that we exist. Well, and so that's one of the reasons why, you know, you're doing my job for me by putting me on your show here.
Hey, this is Dr. Tom Curran, the host of Sound Insight, but also a realtor serving wonderful folks like you in the state of Washington and in Idaho. I've had the privilege and pleasure of helping dozens of families in the last 2.5 years discern and find a strategy, a path, and a plan to help their families find a whole new life in Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho. If I could be of service to you in that, I would love to. Please reach out, drtomcurran.com, drtomcurran.com. Okay, back to Sound Insight.
Well, it's a thrill to do that. Brother Guy Consolmagno is with me today. He's the director of the Vatican Observatory. He is a Jesuit, and he's here leading a retreat this weekend. It begins tonight, brothers and sisters, tonight at 6 o'clock at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center on the South Hill of Spokane. It's IHRC, Immaculate Heart Retreat Center, ihrc.net. If you want to register, call, find out about coming on Saturday if you can't make it to the whole retreat. It's Friday, all day Saturday and Sunday until 1 o'clock with Brother Guy. The energy, the insight, the stories, the theme of faith, science, and beauty in the stars, faith, science, and beauty in the stars is so appropriate and powerful for today. Brother Guy, I want to explore a couple of other things that are happening. It seems as if outer space has gotten more attention in just the last couple of years. Everything from things like SpaceX, and you know, now we're getting more rocket capability to get into outer space. We are considering going back to the moon or to Mars, and we have a new telescope up in outer space that is supposedly going to increase at a whole new level insights into the universe. So let me just start there and just say, when you think about the moment we're living in as it comes to our emergence into outer space with the use of technology, how do you see it?
Well, I've been in this field now 50 years. I'm actually going to my class reunion at MIT in June, 50 years since 1974. And what you have described could have been said about every one of those years, that it was remarkable what we were doing in 1977 compared to what we knew 20 years earlier when Sputnik was being launched, or what we were doing in 1994 compared to what we knew in 1977. And it's absolutely true in 2024. And I hope I'm around to see what it's like in 2034 and 2044. Because it is true, the more you learn, the more you learn how to learn. But of course, the more you learn, the more you realize there is to learn. And it's not the case that, you know, we're running out of things to discover. It's rather that it's so exciting because there is so much more to discover, and because we have the tools to actually look at things that I only dreamt of when I was a student. You know, they were telling me how solar systems might be formed on the basis of one solar system, the only one we could see then. And now there's 5,000 solar systems where we can test our theories and find out, what did we get right? Quite a bit. What did we get wrong? An awful lot of that we got wrong. And the stuff we got wrong in some ways is more fun because it makes you realize, there's stuff going on I didn't even realize. You know, we were wrong, but we were wrong for good reasons. And that's the history of astronomy. That's the history of science. Going wrong for good reasons and then saying, now I know this is a new way of proceeding. I mentioned this partly to plug a book called When Science Goes Wrong. And this is a book that a good buddy of mine, Chris Graney, and I wrote. It came out by Paulist Press. The fact that it's being published by a religious press tells you that we are looking not only at the history of science and some of the wonderful and goofy things that scientists used to believe, with an eye to what are the wonderful and goofy things that we believe now, but also to realize that how we learn things in science can be a model for how we learn things about God, that we should never think we've got it all figured out. We should never think that just, you know, following the rules of the catechism are going to earn us a way into heaven. Boy, is that terrible theology. The catechism is, of course, important because it sets us up. But then the way we live our lives is something that no book can tell us ahead of time how to do, because every one of us has a different life, and every one of us has to take the lessons we learn from a catechism and figure out, okay, how do I apply it here in this tricky situation? And don't be afraid to get it wrong, because God understands. And as long as you're willing to say, got that wrong, let me try to do better, then that's the road to getting it right.
You know, Brother Guy, I'm reading a book by a Jesuit right now. He has a co-author who helped him write it. I'm wondering if you ever met him. His name is Walter Chizik. And he was the, you know, with God in Russia. And then he wrote his own journal, He Leadeth Me. And it is life-changing, his book, He Leadeth Me. And it's his journey. And his journey and the spiritual insights and his way of living the truths of our faith and flesh to them was so jaw-dropping, amazing. So I want to, you know, affirm what you're saying about, no, it's the truths of our faith have to be enfleshed in our lives, and we're on this journey, and it can lead you into these pathways that are completely unexpected, and how they draw you close to Christ and his redemptive work. So did you happen to ever meet Father Chizik? And
not quite. He died, I think, about 84, and I didn't enter the Jesuits until 89. But I entered the Jesuits in Pennsylvania at our novitiate in Wernersville, which is where he's buried. So,
wow.
You know, I would go by his grave many times. And as a novice, they had us cleaning the tombstone. So I've, you know, put the cleaner on his tombstone. Of course, we heard stories about him. And of course, we knew people who knew him. The other place where I ran into him, oddly enough, was at the Vatican Observatory, because we've got a big book of signatures of all the people who have come and visited. And one winter Sunday afternoon, not much to do, I started going through the book to see if there are names I could recognize, and came across a number of them, including Walter Chizik's autograph. He was in Rome just before he went off to Poland, which, of course, where he was when you know, the Russians invaded Poland, captured him, and accused him of being a Vatican spy. So there's his signature just a few months before he was captured by the Russians.
Wow, that gives me chills. That is so amazing.
Well, that's the way I felt when I saw the name, of course, because obviously I'd read those books.
Right. Wow. So continuing on then, I want to ask another question around this theme of growth of understanding. So I love what you said, that any year is an amazing year. Any time is an amazing time in terms of growth and development of insights. So last month, there was a paper that came out in some astrophysical journal about dark matter, and potentially the theory of dark matter might in fact be wrong. And I don't know if that is more hype than real, but that there's an example of a theory that grew in prominence to try to fill a gap of knowledge regarding a phenomenon. And now all of a sudden there's like, no, wait a minute, we might have had this completely incorrect. So is that an example of what you're talking about?
Maybe. I don't think he's right, and I don't think most people think he's right, but it's really important to raise the issues he raises. And that's the way science proceeds. There is a phenomenon that we can observe, a number of phenomena that we can observe, that all seem to be connected to how gravity works at large distances. Maybe it's that the laws of gravity are funny and we have an incomplete understanding, or maybe there's stuff there that affects gravity but doesn't look like the matter that we're used to. And there are ways you test both of those theories. And if there is stuff that we're not used to, then maybe it could be detectable in this way or that way. There is an experiment going on right now in a deep, deep gold mine in South Dakota, where they have a kind of fluid that might interact with the particles that might be dark matter particles, and they might give this predicted result. And there's a buddy of mine who's in charge of, you know, analyzing the data. She's an Italian scientist who's also an adjunct to the Vatican Observatory, because good Catholic, and loves the work we're doing. So that what it all means is we don't know what dark matter is, or more appropriately, we don't know what it is that's causing the effects that are surprising us. And the best we can do is come up with ideas and test them, always knowing that the ideas are going to be incomplete, if not wrong. But that's why we call it dark, because we're in the dark about it. Just as there are effects we now see in the way the universe expands, that makes us realize that there's a kind of energy acting in the universe that is different from any kind of energy we were familiar with in our labs. Something's going on at big scales that is a total surprise to us. And we call it dark energy, again, because we're in the dark. Now, here's the important thing to remember. The newest and best that you see in the papers, 50% of it's going to be wrong. We just don't know which 50% yet. And that's what makes it exciting. And that's why it's worth putting in the papers. But science doesn't progress by big revolutions. Science progresses by a step by step, putting this brick in, putting that brick in. And after you've got about 20 bricks, you step back and you go, that one doesn't fit. What am I going to have to undo to put that out to put a better one in there? You know, the real amazing breakthroughs rarely are even recognized as that at the time. It's only you look back and you go, oh, I started doing that and didn't even realize I was doing it. I started assuming this and didn't even realize I was assuming it. And look where it's led me.
Brother Guy, I gotta tell you, you should be like you're better than AI. I mean, like,
hope so.
I'm serious. Well, I'll tell you, no, you go into Wikipedia and you read an entry on dark matter, and you're gonna be completely lost. Listening to you, it's understandable. I'm stunned. I'm sitting here thinking, wow, I have never heard that issue described, and even connecting it to this new paper that just came out, and it is amazing. Brothers and sisters, Brother Guy is going to be at the Immaculate Retreat Center this weekend, Friday night, 6 o'clock till Sunday at 1, leading a retreat, Faith, Science, and Beauty in the Stars. And the quality of the conversations that you'll have with him, and the way that will lead to an enrichment of faith through the wonder of what God has created, and through the teaching of the church in Pope Francis in Laudato Si, from Genesis all the way to Laudato Si, what a span to cover. Brother Guy, I've got a few more questions, and we're running out of time. I've got a few more questions though, and I want to see if I can get through them. Let's go back to Genesis first. And there's another famous Jesuit, Father George Lemaître, in his underlying thesis that led to the Big Bang Theory.
I got to stop you right there. In reference to Father Lemaître, he was not a Jesuit. He hated it when people would call him a Jesuit.
Really?
But I always point out, you know, it's evidence that you actually can be really smart and not be a Jesuit, rare as that might be. No, Father Lemaître was a diocesan priest with two PhDs in mathematics from Louvain, and then also in astrophysics from MIT. So he was no slouch. And he was the guy who came up with the idea that his enemies made fun of by calling that Big Bang Theory. But, you know, we think he was right.
Okay, so I want you to connect this to a phenomenon that has reemerged in, let's say, maybe the last 10 years in Catholic circles. And it's a form of creationism or young earth theory. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I'm bumping into more and more. Would you talk a little bit about that and help Catholics that are listening to this? How do they wrap their minds around that?
Well, first of all, it comes from a very insidious temptation. that hits all of us. It's the temptation that was known in Roman times as Gnosticism, that I've got the secret knowledge that nobody else has, that I'm a little bit smarter than you because I realize, unlike everybody else in the world, that I've got this new secret way of looking at the universe. Maybe I discovered it on the internet. And yeah, you know, the fact is, if it's on the internet, anybody can find it. But the fact that I found it in my basement at 3 a.m. makes it feel like it's special to me. And it's this lust for secret knowledge. And if you think that that's a modern phenomenon, what do you think the snake was whispering to Adam and Eve? You know, it was, oh, I've got the stuff God doesn't want to have you know. So be wary of any kind of secret knowledge that makes you a little bit smarter than the other guy. Why do you want to be smarter than the other guy? I'd much rather be better, a better human being, not than the other guy, but than the guy I was yesterday. You know, that's the only accomplishment that really matters. Beyond that, there is in our culture a desire to treat books as if the truth in the book is the truth of the actual words, the way that the owner's manual to your Volkswagen tells you how to change a tire in a Volkswagen. And so, you know, the gospel ought to tell you how to change a tire in your spiritual. No, the gospel is not an owner's manual. The gospel is a wonderful, important, very true story, but even the truths that it tells you about what really happened with Jesus were arranged in a way by the author to lead you from those truths to even more important truths. And when you look at other scripture, you look at the Old Testament, you've got a library of books, and some of them are histories. And of course, histories are always written with a point of view. Otherwise, it wouldn't have any value as a history. But you'll find, you know, the same historical events written from two different points of view in two different books in the Old Testament. Doesn't mean that one's right and one's wrong. You find books of poetry. What's more marvelous than the Psalms and the ways that they can use poetry to bring us to God, a God who cannot be trapped in human words? There are books of comedy. You know, Jonah is a satire on the world's worst prophet. And you notice at the beginning, unlike all the other books of prophets, it doesn't say under the reign of such and such and so. It basically starts out once upon a time. So you know that's what the story is all about. What is Genesis? Genesis was an attempt by the Jewish scholars who had been carried off in the Babylonian captivity to say, let's take a look at the best science of the day, Babylonian science, the 600 years ago, and see really where God fits into this. Because the Babylonians had a way of looking at the world. They thought the world was flat. They thought there was a dome and water above and below and all the other bits. But the Babylonians thought that human beings were made by a mistake of the gods. The Babylonians thought that the best thing human beings would ever do was the city of Babylon. And the writers of Genesis said, well, no, let's take the science we know of how the world works. They're not telling you that the world is flat. They're saying, okay, everybody knows the world's flat. That's not the point. What everybody doesn't know was that in the beginning, God's already there. And there's only one God. Nobody else told you that. We're telling you that. Nobody else knows that in the beginning, God, the very first thing is let there be light, so that nothing's hidden. Nobody else is telling you that. What we're telling you is that the creation of the universe occurred in a way as logical as day follows night. It's not a random accident of the gods. Nobody else is telling you that. We're saying that it was done deliberately by God and that at every step along the way, he looks at it and says, this is good stuff. This works. Nobody else is telling you that. And what is the goal of creation? What is the final endpoint? What is not the city of Babylon, the peak, but what is it really that we're all directed at? The Sabbath. The day when we do more than just fill our stomachs, but instead we contemplate this marvelous universe by being poets, by being artists, by being astronomers. This is why we're different from the other animals. And you know what? Each one of those lessons is new. It's profound. It's incredibly important. We couldn't do science without believing them. If you thought the world was just the random, you know, occurrence of a bunch of nature gods, there's no way you could be a scientist. If you thought the world was evil, there's no way you'd want to study the physical world. This is the foundation of science. And these truths are true regardless of how you think the world was made. Because you find these truths in chapter 3 of Genesis, or chapter 2 of Genesis, or in the book of Job, which has a completely different creation story, or the book of 2 Maccabees, where a mother, a nameless mother, says to her child, "Don't be afraid of what the king's going to do to you, because we were created by the God who made the universe out of nothing." It doesn't matter what you think the stages are, the lessons of Genesis become true, are true, are importantly true regardless. So if you're just looking at Genesis like the owner's manual to your Volkswagen, you're missing all of the important stuff.
I love that. That's, again, I'm talking with Brother Guy, and he's a not-to-be-missed speaker opportunity as he's going to lead a retreat. Begins tonight, 6 o'clock until Sunday at 1 o'clock. And again, if you can't be there for the whole retreat, talk to the folks at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center and find out when you can engage. I'm sure Brother Guy would love to have you there as much as you can. Again, it begins tonight at 6. There are obviously accommodations and meals and the full range of things that you'll have on a retreat. And the theme of the retreat is on faith, science, and beauty in the stars. Okay, so Brother Guy, last question. We're going out into outer space more and more with the abilities that we have technologically in the telescopes. We're seeing 10,000 solar systems and speculating about how many millions of galaxies that have billions and trillions of solar systems with planets. Well, extraterrestrial life. Is there anything that would say anything new under the sun that has come to you and come to mainstream science and astrophysicists regarding the idea that there might be intelligent life beyond our solar system?
The way you've asked that question is brilliant, because there isn't anything new. There's no reason to believe or disbelieve any more now than 50 years or 100 years, because we've always known how that the universe was really big. You find that in scripture. You find that in Psalm 8. And we've also realized that God created us and the stars and creatures who are in a relationship with God that may be different from how human beings have a relationship. What do you think angels are? What do you think the Psalms mean when they talk about the stars singing for joy at the one who created them? So there's nothing in our theology that rules it out or demands it. You know, I'm not going to tell God what he could make or not make. But here's the fun thing. Asking the question, especially, you know, in light of the science fiction that we've all grown up with and loved, certainly I love it. Asking the question, would you baptize an extraterrestrial? Forces you to ask the question, what do I mean by an alien? You know, if they have intellect and free will, the touchstones of a human soul, how are they any more alien than, you know, my older brother? If they're in a relationship with God, do they need baptism? What is baptism? How does baptism work? And I don't have the answers to these things, but I say in the context of other intelligent creatures, the questions take on a new flavor. They're a lot more fun to ponder, because the best kinds of questions are not the ones that you come up with an answer and then you throw it away. They're the ones that you keep going back to and coming in with new insights. Oddly enough, I got another book called Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? I wrote it with a good friend of mine, Paul Muller, and he's a theologian, so he's got all the good answers, or really the good pondering points. And the subtitle is, you know, and all the other crazy things that people keep asking us. So I think they made us take the word crazy out. But it's a fun book because it takes the big questions of, you know, what is the Big Bang? Is there an end to the universe? what the heck, what was the Star of Bethlehem? And the answer is, we don't know, if you're looking for the kind of answer that would show up in the back of your physics book. But when you ponder it, here are some of the things you might want to think about. And those can be a lot of fun.
Beautiful. That's, again, Brother Guy Consul Magno. He is a Jesuit brother. He's here at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center this weekend. Please come out for faith, science, and beauty in the stars. Brother Guy, thank you so much for all the time you've given me. Yes.
It's a delight. And if you can't make it, can I just invite you to go online and look up VaticanObservatory.org, and you'll find out who we are and what we do and find a lot of fun stuff there, too.
That's awesome. VaticanObservatory.org. Brother Guy, thank you so much for taking time to be with me today.